طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of This Week in Palestine, which features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, that is rarely reflected in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. We have a very full program, which will fill most of the hour this morning, so let's get to it. This morning we feature a discussion with Niam Atik, a Palestinian Episcopal priest and director of the Sabil Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center in Jerusalem, and journalist and author Max Blumenthal, along with Tariq Abwata of Friends of Sabil North America. This is a presentation of the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. We begin with opening words from the moderator, Max Blumenthal.
I guess I'm the moderator. Welcome. I always I always wonder where all the young people are at my events. I guess they're not as woke or they have work. But I always say never trust anyone under 30 these days. Better. I also want to welcome Camera to the event. They've done a lot of good free publicity for me over the years, so I'm hoping for more. I guess we should just get right into it. I mean, great timing or bad, terrible timing for your tour, but it's certainly momentous. I was watching I-24. It's kind of Israel's, it's a state media channel. And it's aimed at broadcasting to the outside world and presenting Israel to the outside world, presenting the debates within Israel. And they did a segment on Tel Aviv after Netta won, you know, the Eurovision contest. It was a really I don't know if any of you are familiar with Eurovision. Israel participates for some reason in Eurovision, even though it's not a European country. I mean, obviously, it embodies a lot of European qualities. And they won with this really unique competition. Netanyahu is seen kind of like in front of the cameras imitating the singer doing this chicken dance. And people were out celebrating in Tel Aviv while, you know, a few kilometers away on the Gaza border, Israeli snipers with laser rangefinders were gunning down young men, flinging themselves at an electrified fence and concertina wire. 58 were killed. And at around this same time, you had the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem with Ivanka Trump, the presidential son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and a collection of pastors who have some unusual views about Jews, which we'll get into. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen the memes of Ivanka opening the embassy. There's some really creative memes where someone photoshopped Trump's comments to Billy Bush on Inside Edition, you know, where he's talking about grabbing them by the rosaries, or I don't know. He's a great moral paragon. So you have all of these events happening at once, and it really embodies, first of all, the contradictions of Israel, which really and it really reflects, I think, the most severe vision of our own contradictions in the West. And left off the table is the narrative of the Palestinians, the lives of those who ran into the towards snipers who wanted to show the world that they had been under siege for 12 years and for 58 more had been dispossessed, and the experiences of Palestinians in Jerusalem who will be directly affected by this embassy decision. You know, this is a city that's obviously very important to the three Abrahamic faiths, but it's also where just real people live, including 300,000 or so Palestinians. So I want to just get both of your reactions to these events. And, you know, I think, and then we can talk also about some of the religious undercurrents, dangerous religious undercurrents that you've written about in the past, Naim. But just your immediate reaction to the events in the past week.
Well, it's not only bad days. They are sad days. It's tragic days for our people and for all of our friends who have been working for a just peace for many, many years, you know. So, but, you know, I feel it's not the end of Jerusalem in that sense. I don't think it is the President of the United States, no matter who he is, and no matter how powerful he is. I don't think we have seen the end of or the final destiny of Jerusalem, city of Jerusalem. I think it cannot be determined. The destiny of Jerusalem cannot be determined by what a powerful person says. If it is not endorsed by the international community and by international law, as far as I'm concerned, it means nothing. You know, so I think we need to continue knowing that the people of power have been able to manage this and make a decision, but that's not the end of it. So that I just want to put it out right there. So we still need to continue working for justice and for peace for all the people of the land.
Tarek, you have any comments you want to offer?
Boy, do I. When I was speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus, this is about 10 years ago, at the end of my talk, Bernard Lafayette, whom was mentioned protege of Martin Luther King, asked me to go in his place. He said, I'm getting too old. They're tired of hearing about me. Why don't you go and give a newer message about Palestine? I spoke about my grandmother. I spoke about that wall, that, you know, that 30-foot concrete wall. That is her backyard fence. And I told the tragedy in Palestine, Steny Hoyer at the time, and John Lewis walked right into the presentation, hadn't heard it, and Steny Hoyer looked at me and said, had the Palestinians had a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King, they wouldn't be where they are today. I didn't respond at the time. I was much younger, and I just took it in. I would have responded, would you tell the same people on this Black Congressional Caucus the same thing back in 1940s and 50s? And then you ask us as Palestinians, where are your Gandhis? Well, 60 of them were shot in the past 2 days. If that is not nonviolence on the ground from Palestinians, I don't know what is. I come from Texas. You don't step on our backyard in Texas. You wear your cowboy boots and you shoot if somebody comes in your backyard. These folks, in 70 years, a lot of these people have been refugees in camps in Gaza and all around Palestine. So don't ask me where the Palestinian Gandhis are, where nonviolence is. It's been practiced for the past 100 years by Palestinians, and we're shooting them down. And don't expect for people to give you and pass out flowers after you have sieged them for 10 years, and 50% of them malnutritioned or not enough food to eat, and 50% without enough resources, electricity, and water. So the situation is dire, and our churches have to speak up more, and I know we'll get into that in a bit.
Well, you know, and there's so much bad faith. I mean, you mentioned people's this constant mantra of demanding the Palestinian Gandhi. Where's the Palestinian Gandhi? You had a Thomas Friedman at the dawn of the Arab Spring to write this column where he says, you know, that if the youth of Palestine would just get out there and march in Jerusalem and march to the wall and just march against the occupation in this giant mass march and just start marching towards Israel, the world will respect them and Israelis will come and join their brothers and sisters and hug them and run across the street and sing Kumbaya. I mean, he's essentially saying, you know, go out and do that while I sit here in Chevy Chase in my well-tended lawn and watch you. That essentially, in so many ways, happened last week. Thomas Friedman went on Anderson Cooper and he said, Hamas is sacrificing the youth of Gaza, and they are essentially to blame for their own deaths. So this is the bad faith that we constantly see from our opinion makers. They actually don't want a Palestinian Gandhi. I always said this. They want a kind of a Palestinian Dalai Lama who will exist in exile and do peace concerts with celebrities while they basically take the whole place. We saw some really disturbing theology on display in Jerusalem. I mean, first on the Jewish side, you have extreme religious nationalists like Yitzhak Yosef, who is the son of the former Sephardic chief rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who's had some disturbing things to say about non-Jews. Yitzhak Yosef recently delivered a sermon comparing black people, in his words, kushim, which is, you know, considered sort of offensive, to monkeys. And he blessed Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Also on the scene was Robert Jeffress. You might know him because you're from Texas. Robert Jeffress, when he was on the early early in his career in the 90s, he was doing this campaign on the border of Oklahoma, where he was taking books out of the local library that had gay themes in them. It was a campaign, "Gay is not okay," and basically he'd raise money from his parishioners to pay for the books so they wouldn't be in the library because he would refuse to return them. This is someone who's not operating, in my view, on a pluralistic, democratic, normal plane. He's also said that Jews are going to hell. Jews or Mormons and Muslims are going to hell. They can't be saved. This was the person who delivered the opening benediction. The closing benediction was delivered by someone most of you are familiar with, John Hagee, the most prominent Christian Zionist in the world. As I reported in 2006, AIPAC actually helped set up his organization, Christians United for Israel. Pastor Hagee at his Cornerstone Church in Texas has declared that the Antichrist will be like Hitler, half Jewish and homosexual with fierce features. So he has said that the Antichrist will be a half-breed Jew. That is Pastor John Hagee, who delivered the closing benediction at the U.S. Embassy alongside the presidential son-in-law, the Orthodox Jewish, Jared Kushner. Weird, right? It seems weird, but actually I think it actually embodies a lot of what Zionism represents, which is a collaboration between anti-Semites in the West who would like a West free of Jews, and Zionists, traditional Zionists, who believe that anti-Semitism is actually a force that can help propel Jews into making Aliyah or emigrating to the Holy Land and helping drive this project of colonization. So there actually is this symbiotic relationship that was on display, and it's a traditional relationship, which is very disturbing. Naim, you wrote in your book, this is not your new book, this is Justice and Only Justice, but it's still a very worthy book, that Christian Zionists represent an omen of hate. What do you mean by an omen of hate, and how has Christian Zionism affected not only the lives of Palestinians, but how do you face this challenge as a Christian in the United States?
Well, Christian Zionism actually goes back many years before 1948. So from the beginning of the 19th century, we have the creation, the emergence of Christian Zionists. And these were Christians, evangelical, fundamentalist, extremist Christians who, on the basis of their study of the scriptures, of the Bible, believed that in order for them to speed up the second coming of Christ, they need to get all the Jews to Palestine. Because in their interpretation of the Bible, Jews need to be there so that the final battle in history, the Battle of Armageddon, in their interpretation, will take place, and two-thirds of the Jewish people will be massacred, and the last third would become Christian. This is part of the teaching of Christian Zionism. It goes back to those early years. I'm talking about 1830s, 1840s. I'm talking in the 1840s, a Christian Zionist by the name of Lord Shaftesbury in England was lobbying the British government to send all British Jews back to Palestine. because he believed exactly what I told you, you know, about the interpretation of the scripture. In the United States, this type of teaching that actually started in Europe, in England, in Britain at the time, came to the United States by a person, John Nelson Darby. Again, he was born in the 1800s, early 1800s. And he came here and he talked about his dispensationalist perspective, which basically talked about what is going to happen at the end days, the end times of this. And one of his disciples was William Blackstone from Chicago, and he started lobbying President Harrison to send American Jews to Palestine in order to speed up the second coming of Christ. Yeah. And then Cyrus Scofield wrote his famous Scofield Bible, and which many fundamentalist American Christians were brought up on the Scofield Bible. And this, it was not, and then what happened is that his commentary on the Bible was perceived as part of inspired biblical, the Bible, you know. So they could not differentiate between the commentary of Scofield and the biblical text. It all became one for American Christian fundamentalist, and you still have in the United States millions of these Christian Zionists. And so this guy, Jeffers, who's, I think he's the pastor of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, he's one of those. John Hagee is one of those, except John Hagee, because of his relationship with Israel, he started changing, modifying, you know, his stance. But basically, they all believe in the second coming of Christ, and that Jews, ultimately, most of them will be massacred, and the last third will become Christian. Now, for many years, Jewish Israelis and Jewish Americans would not even have anything to do with these Christian Zionists, because they felt they were anti-Semitic, and they are, in their view, anti-Semitic. But later on, most of them said, well, Jews would say, I don't really accept their theology, I don't accept their interpretation of the Bible, but we need them because they are very much pro-Israel. And they are very much committed to the state of Israel and against the Palestinians in that sense. So that's what has happened since 2000, I think. Since the year 2000, some of the Jews said, we welcome Christian Zionists because of their utmost loyalty to Israel. And I think some of them were there in Jerusalem. This time I heard about other people who went there because of this type of theology, which we would say it is bad interpretation of the Bible, it's bad understanding of the theology of the end times. It is unacceptable, but that's what we have.
It bears mentioning that when you talk about dispensations, I mean, a dispensation can come in the form of war. Pastor John Hagee has a book, Jerusalem Countdown, in which he favors a war on Iran in order to hasten the second coming. So you have essentially an apocalypse lobby, a national apocalypse lobby. I went to Christians United for Israel. You can watch my video, Rapture Ready. It's on YouTube. And I interviewed various attendees of the Christians United for Israel's 2007 Washington Israel Summit. And I said, are you looking forward to the apocalypse? One after another. I'm looking forward to the apocalypse and the cleansing of the earth. I mean, that kind of rhetoric. Looking forward to it. I'm not. Well, actually, maybe I am, because I'll get their cars and stuff. I mean, they're going to be raptured up, so I'll be here. But on that note, I mean, you know, we've watched Christian communities come under attack in the Middle East from Israel and Lebanon, for example, in 2006. A lot of people don't know there's a Christian community in the Gaza Strip. Many people in during Operation Protective Edge in 2014, and I was in Gaza for part of that, took shelter in a Christian church because the church was not going to be targeted. Bethlehem is, of course, you know, just bleeding its Christian population because of the separation wall, because of so many factors related to the occupation. Why is there no solidarity between these conservative evangelical Christians and these Christian communities, which go back to the time of the apostles? Why is that? It was something that I think a lot of people wonder. Why are they considered collateral damage by so many evangelical Christians in the United States?
Yeah, they believe that we are nominal Christians. We are not really the true Christians. And I've heard it for many, you know, because they don't come to Sabil when they come to Jerusalem. They don't go to see the Christian churches, the indigenous churches of the land. And if you ask them, they will say, these are not good Christians. They are the ones who are they are the only good Christians in their view, because they think that we have to be converted to real Christianity, to the true religious faith. And that's why, you know, they don't consider us at all as true believers, true converted Christians in that sense. And it's very sad. So they would put us almost on the same category like the Muslims in that sense, that we also, not only the Muslims need to be converted, that the nominal Christians of the land need to be converted, you know. And so... They will side with Israel against anyone who is not pro-Israel at all. So that's part of the whole thing. And you know, when the churches, you mentioned about some people in Gaza went and to find refuge in the church. Actually, our church in Gaza, which is in the Ahli Arab Hospital, was bombed by the Israelis. And I don't know whether it's still been renovated. And I think the church tried to get the Israeli government to pay for the damage. And to my knowledge, I don't think they did. Do you have, I don't think they, and the NGO? The bomb is still in the- Yeah. So, I mean, people think that Israel, the government of Israel, likes the Christians more than the Muslims. But in actual fact, they don't like us both, because they don't like the Palestinians. And we are Palestinians, whether we are Christians or Muslims, we are Palestinians. So the war of 1948 was not against Islam or the Muslims. It was against the Palestinians. You know, we were driven out. In my home, Bisan, they did not ask us, are you a Christian? You can stay. Are you a Muslim? You need to go. Nobody asked us that way. Actually, what they did in Bisan, they put us two categories, Muslims and Christians, but they sent all the Muslims to Jordan, and they sent all the Christians into Nazareth, you know, at the time, you know. But in terms of taking the land, they wanted the land of Palestine, but they did not want the people of the land, the indigenous people of the land.
Let's go back to Bisan. I mean, it was Nakba Day this week. It was the 70th observance of the dispossession, a systematic dispossession of Palestinians. 750,000 Palestinians were forced from their homes and their land. And leading up to 1948, we have to recognize that over 200 villages had already been ethnically cleansed by that point, by the point that David Ben-Gurion declared quote-unquote independence. This is already a project well underway, but this is obviously the heart of the issue. I think that is a much larger motivating factor in these protests than the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. You were 11 years old.
Yes.
At this point.
Yeah.
Talk. Just tell us what happened and how it influenced your perspective and led you to this Palestinian theory of liberation.
Yeah. Well, as an 11-year-old, I remember details of my life in Bisan and what happened. So I remember a beautiful town. I remember a town, God blessing it with so many springs of beautiful water, all the mountains around Bisan, the pools that we had, the springs that we had. I remember the garden that my father had, which he, when he bought a piece of land and built three houses on it. My father was a goldsmith and silversmith, and he was the only jeweler in town. And around Bisan, over 20 villages and towns, all of them came to Bisan because Bisan was the capital of that region, you know. It had a bank, it had a post office. I'm talking about in the 1940s, you know, end of 1940s. So it was a beautiful place. And my father, when he got this land, we had a canal of beautiful spring water coming through our land. And I would help my father in irrigating the land. My father planted trees, fruit trees, in Bisan, in our garden. You might be familiar with one type of fig trees. We had four or five different types of fig trees in our land. The pomegranates, the bananas. Who has banana trees in their homes? But Bisan, we had it. You know, the oranges, the grapefruits that we had, the lemons. I mean, it was unbelievable. I have all this, plus the vegetable garden that we had in Bisan. It was a beautiful place. And our life totally was disrupted, totally disrupted, when the Zionists came into Bisan. And I was playing outside. Our house was on the main street of town, going through the town. And I remember, you know, seeing those Zionist troops going through. There was no war, no battle. They just occupied us. And a few days later, the military governor sent after the heads of the different churches and the Muslim community. In fact, I remember well that the word came to my father. My father represented the small Episcopal Anglican church in Bisan. And they sent after these heads. So I remember my father asking me to go to the Latin priest and ask him to come to our house, to the Orthodox Church priest, and to come up. And my father asked me to go to the other side of town to the Qadi. Qadi is the judge, the Muslim judge of the town. And he asked me to go ask the Qadi to come to our home, because they were sent after by the military Jewish governor of Bisan. And I did. And they all came, and then I saw them leave to go to the military governor. And the military governor told them, you have 2 hours to get out of town. And my father pleaded with him, told him, I have 10 children. My two kids, older kids, are married and they have kids. There is nowhere we can go. This is our home. This is where we are. You've occupied us. Allow us to stay in our homes. And I remember my father telling us, he said, no way. If you don't leave, we will kill you. My father came to the house and he said, we're asked to get out. We must meet at the center of town. Carry whatever you can, light and valuable. We cannot take anything more with us. I remember my father was well-to-do. So we had our own bakery in the house. He had built it. So in those days, people would prepare the dough, and then they go to different bakeries. But we did not have to go, because one of my seven sisters, you know, was our baker. So she would do the bakery, and another sister would prepare the dough, you know. And we had the dough prepared for that day. And my father said, you know, get the oven, you know, and let's take the bread, you know, the bread. And immediately, the dough was not even ripe for baking. But we had to do it because they said 2 hours, you need to get out. So anyway, we carried the fresh bread. And we went to the center of town, and that's where they divided us. And they said, Muslims on one side, Christians on the other. And then they took all the Muslims down the River Jordan, which was few kilometers away, few miles away, maybe 3 miles at the most, you know, to the Jordan. And they told the Muslims, go to the King Abdullah. This is the grandfather of the present king in Jordan. And they took all of us Christians. At that time, Nazareth was still with the Palestinians, with the Arabs. It was not occupied. They dumped us on the outskirts of Nazareth. And then the buses and cars started coming from Nazareth to pick us up. We were very fortunate. I mean, we became refugees, that's right. But my father was able to smuggle out the gold. And my sisters hid that gold under their dresses. And so we came to Nazareth, and the Anglican Church took us in. The priest there took us in. They closed the schools because of the war, and we occupied the school. Not only us, my family, but several Anglican families that came out from Bisan. And so we stayed in the school. According to the family, one room, one classroom or more, you know, to accommodate these people. And we only had the clothes on our back, you know. I experienced that. And one of the hardest things I remember, I wanted a banana as a boy. I said, I want a banana. And back home, we had the bananas all hanging, you know, those big, I don't know what you call them in English, but they were all hanging there in the oven, in the bakery, so that they can become ripe, you know. And I was so upset because when they got me a banana, I could only have one banana. One banana, when we had all the bananas and all the oranges and all the fruits and the teen, the figs and so on, you know. It was unbelievable. But we had to adjust in Nazareth. And what happened to my family, you have to imagine, happened to thousands and thousands of Palestinian families throughout Palestine. Some people fled because they already heard about what the Zionists had done in Deir Yassin and the massacre of over 100 men, women, and children in Deir Yassin. So some people fled. We did not flee at gunpoint. We had to leave Bisan. And then, as you mentioned, in order to prevent the refugees from returning, the government of Israel bulldozed around 500 villages and towns throughout Palestine. And you can find maps. If you Google, you will find the maps of the different villages and towns that have been bulldozed in order to prevent the Palestinians from returning. Now, our homes in Bisan, most of our homes in Bisan were not demolished. They brought Jewish families from North Africa, especially Morocco, that took over our homes in Bisan. And I remember 10 years later, because we could not move after that, we could not get out of Nazareth without a military permit. If you wanted to go from Nazareth to another place, you had to have permit. I remember the people who just, you know, families divided and so on. If I wanted to go to Haifa, I had to have a military permit. And then I found out that 10 years, they allowed us to go back to Bisan, or people were allowed to go to their original home only on the day of the independence of the State of Israel. I'm sorry to take this long time, but let me just end by saying we went back to Bisan after 10 years. And we knocked on the door of our home. We had a big home there. And we found out that there were a number of families. They divided our house into different parts. And my father said, can we go in and say, and this woman just shut the door in his face and told him, that's our home. It's not. We went back to Nazareth. In a few days, my father had a stroke, and he never recovered. And he passed away. He died after 5 years of the what do you call it, the stroke that he had, you know, there. So this is part of our story in Bisan.
Yeah. And you know, as you explained, it's ongoing. The Nakba is a continuous, ongoing process. Let's talk about a little bit more history. I think that you gathered your theory of liberation during the First Intifada, am I correct?
Yes.
And that was, you were doing conversions, but you'd also studied theology at San Francisco State?
Berkeley.
At Berkeley, I'm sorry, California. At Berkeley, just before the Intifada.
Yes.
And leading up to that, you wrote about in your book the campaigns of Joseph Raya.
Yes.
In Christian areas in what is now Israel, in organizing people. He was one of the first priests to organize people.
Yes.
You know, put this all together for us. You know, just how did this lead to, how did this crystallize into your theory of liberation, being a part of the Intifada, the backdrop of Raya's campaigns and studying in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's a journey. It has been a journey. And, you know, that Nakba that was ongoing, it never really finished because Israel, the government of Israel, started confiscating Palestinian land continuously, you know, and the situation, you know, the discrimination, you know, the loss of identity, the loss of, I mean, in my new book, I mentioned not only one Nakba, I mentioned three Nakbas that we were subjected to. But I believe that one of the first people to raise the whole question of justice for the Palestinians from a religious perspective was a priest by the name of Joseph Raya. He was Lebanese, but most of his education was in Palestine, and he felt Palestinian, you know, and he studied in Jerusalem, and he was ordained in Jerusalem also, before he was asked to go to Birmingham, Alabama, to be the parish priest of the Melkite community in Birmingham. And while in Birmingham, he marched with Martin Luther King. So he absorbed the technique of nonviolent resistance. And while in Birmingham, we lost, or the bishop, the Melkite bishop in Haifa, retired, and the Melkites chose Raya as a bishop. So he was ordained, and he came to Haifa. I had just started my ministry at the end of 1966. In 1988, he came to Haifa, and he started coming to the different places. When he came to Shafa Amir, where I was the parish priest there, I was asked by the other clergy in town to give the welcome to Bishop Raya, and I did that, and as a result of this and other things, we became good friends. And then I was transferred from Shafa Amir to Haifa, where he was. So I used to see him more. Bishop Raya felt that he can now raise the question of Palestine. So he was very smart. So he took the case of Ikrit and Kufr Bir'im, if you remember that. Kufr Bir'im and Ikrit were two Christian villages in the north of Palestine that were evicted by the Zionist militias. And they told the villagers, after 2 weeks, you can come back. Well, the 2 weeks ran into years, as you know. So the villagers went to the Supreme Court in Israel and said, look, this is what happened. These are the papers. So the Supreme Court, at least in that case, they were honest. So they ruled that the villagers should go back to their villages. Golda Meir was the prime minister at the time, the one who said there are no Palestinians. So she refused to honor, to implement its own Supreme Court ruling. And the Israeli army went and demolished the two villages. One of the villages was demolished on Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve. So Bishop Raya said to the Israeli government, your ruling, you need to implement it. And so he started demonstrating. He started having people, sit-ins. He will come from Haifa with many people. And not only Christians joined him, many Muslims and many communists in those days. And the Communist Party was made up of Christians, Muslims, and Jews. The Socialist Party. So they all started doing it. One Sunday in August, during that period, he became Bishop 68, 68, 69, and was there until 74. One Sunday, he told all the churches, Melka churches, to close down and ring toll the bell with a toll of the al-huzun, the grief, the funeral toll, and announce the death of justice in Israel. He was an amazing guy, amazing guy. And the government of Israel would not budge. And then they started putting pressure on Raya. Russia came from outside and from inside. And finally, poor guy, he had to resign his see and get out of the country. And he came to Canada. And I came twice to Canada during that period, and I saw him. And I told him how much I have appreciated his stance for justice. And he died in Canada. So that was one time in which the voice of justice was heard. And then Elias Shakur took over from Raya because he was one of his priests, young priests. And then Palestinian liberation theology started with the first intifada in 87, 88.
Tell us, what is your vision of Palestinian liberation theology? And, I have your book. I also have James Cone's Black Theology of Liberation. James Cone recently passed away. He makes explicit mention to the Palestinian struggle in his book. He draws a lot of inspiration from it. And we also have the model of liberation theology in Latin America. Archbishop Romero, who was assassinated during sermon at the height of the Salvadoran Civil War, is the person that we think of most. This is a theology that was attacked by the CIA through the Vatican. All of these theologies have come under extreme pressure. Black theology of liberation has come under pressure from prosperity gospel, phony gospel of T.D. Jakes. It's a worship of capitalism. And Palestinian the Palestinian theology of liberation has come under attack from so many sides. But, you know, what is it and why is it seen as such a threat to so many in power, and how is it different or similar to these other two streams of thought that I mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, liberation theology tries to be true to its name, liberation, where there is oppression, where there is injustice. In Latin America, it was economic injustice. One I remember while you were talking, one of the liberation theologians, a bishop, who said, when I help the poor, they call me a saint. When I say, why are they poor? They call me a communist. Amazing. So when you begin to ask the right questions about what's happening, why are these people oppressed? What's the origin of the injustice? And so on. People in power don't like that. They want to dominate. They want to take the land. I'm talking about Palestine. They want to push the people out, the indigenous people of the land. So liberation theology, when it started at St. George's Cathedral when I was the parish priest there. In 87, when the Intifada started, I was just like many other priests, trying just to be faithful to God in serving the people. And I decided, with the Intifada, I decided to invite our people in the church to stay after church every Sunday for 1 hour in order to really talk about what's happening on the ground, what's happening in the streets. I think you were there. Yep. You know, Tom Getman, I think Karen May came later. Yeah. And so, in the beginning, it would seem like a session of therapy, you know, because what people did, they came and they told the stories of what was happening outside. And they'll bring it out, you know, the anger, the frustration, you know, the sadness, the tragedies of their own tragedies and the tragedies of their neighbors. You know, people beaten up, people in jail, people, you know, killed and so on. That was the thing. And people would talk about it. But then we started deepening the discussion at St. George's. And more Christians started coming from the Orthodox churches and the Catholic churches of the land. And so the numbers swelled at St. George's, you know. People who wanted to come and express what's happening there. And basically, we were talking about how can we live our life of faith under an oppressive occupation. And talk about the need for liberation and what does that mean. And the discussion became deeper and broader when people started seeing Jesus as a paradigm of liberation. Because they started saying, my goodness, Jesus was born under occupation, the Roman occupation. Jesus lived all his life under occupation. All his ministry, his teaching, his healing, his interaction with people, all was done living life under a very oppressive Roman occupation. It was amazing. Yeah. And at the end, he was killed by the occupation forces in collusion with the religious leaders of the day. And usually when there is injustice, many times it's not only the political powers, it's also the religious powers that are in collusion with the political powers. So the people were talking about this at St. George's. And especially when it came to the point in which they started seeing Jesus Christ as a Palestinian living under occupation. So immediately they started identifying with Jesus. And that's when Jesus becomes the liberator, the paradigm of liberation. That's the beginning. And providentially, all this happened when my manuscript for the first book was ready. And it was sent to Orbis Books through Mark Ellis, who is a Jewish liberation theologian. He wrote about Jewish liberation theology. And he came to Jerusalem, and I went to listen to his, and I saw how he was attacked by the Jewish people in Jerusalem, West Jerusalem. And I was there, and Shakur was there. And I went to him and invited him to come to my home at St. George's. And he came with his family. And I gave him to look at my dissertation. And he said, I'm going to take it to Orbis. And a year later, 1989, the book was published. But already Palestinian liberation theology had started by the people themselves. And I'm not exaggerating if I tell you that the best ideas came from the Palestinian Christians who were feeling the oppression, and they were beginning to express it, you know, and when they were talking about it, the best ideas came from them. And they were profound, I would say profound liberation theologians, you know, the simple people who feel the oppression, and they're saying, what does it mean for me to be faithful to God, you know, in resisting the oppression and the injustice there. That was the beginning of Palestinian liberation theology, and from there it started spreading in Palestine and, thank God, to other places of the world.
Yeah. I guess we got to go to the audience soon. I guess two more questions. I want to ask Tarek, just talk about the work of Friends of Sabeel.
Yeah, give me a break.
Yeah.
Let this guy speak. Thank you.
Take a breather for a second. Get ready for round two. But I've participated in some of your conferences. You have a really powerful constituency across the country, very energized constituency. I mean, what kind of work are you doing in this country? And you know, how do you practice Palestinian theology of liberation in the diaspora?
So what's been very difficult.
He's taking a breather, so not.
What's been very difficult, as you guys were talking, and Reverend Naeem, we're talking about the neocon Christians connecting to the Zionist forces in Israel. Okay, fair enough. The problem is the indigenous peoples, the Palestinian Christians, don't have the same support from the mainline Christians in this country. That's where the problem is. And so when we don't have our own support and parallel connections, that's where we suffer as Palestinian Christians. So we're always starting at negative, not just with the Zionist Christians, but with the mainline denominations who still have streams of Zionism in their theology.
That's right.
So the election, chosenness, all these ideologies are still preached from our pulpits today.
Covenant land.
Covenant.
Yeah, the covenant.
So when I talk about an anti-racist God that is inclusive of all. Yes, we might talk about it in the pulpit. It sounds great. When we talk about the divinity of Jesus, but yet practicing as Jesus was on the ground under Roman occupation and how he faced that and resisted that, wonderful. We can talk from the pulpits about the prophetic nature of Jesus' work. And Jesus went all around these rural villages and then hit at the center of the empire in Jerusalem. That was very tactical and strategic on his part, right? We talk about all of this, but do we practice it in our churches? When I go around and talk about FOSNAS programs, something as simple as become an HP-free church. That's one of our programs. What does that mean? HP is one of the companies that profits from occupying our people at the checkpoints that provide security. And so when we have such a small commitment as become an HP-free church, take a stand for Palestine, that becomes to churches, mainline stream churches, very political. But that's what Christianity is. Christianity is political, is social, is economic. That's exactly what Reverend Naeem is talking about. That is liberation theology. If that is threatening any church, that means that church is not in line with any people's liberation, including the Palestinians. So our work in FOSNA is to push the church into taking these momentum acts of liberation for Palestinians. And to talk about a few programs specifically, so in the churches, the praxis of it becomes very problematic for the churches. But if you want to be prophetic, you take action. We have a conference in September. It is right before the U.S. Campaigns Conference, September 28th and 29th is the U.S. campaign. Ours is the 27th. If you're an organizer, please, you are invited to this conference. We are the Christian space along with the Palestine-Israel networks and the churches in order to highlight these injustices and to highlight the intersectionalities of the struggle with the movement for Black Lives, with other prophetic immigrant and Latina movements as coalitions that divest our resources, not just from the denominations at the church level of denominations divesting from these companies. But now the fight has become at a local state level. What do I mean? Municipalities also, local governments, invest. So Berkeley and Portland were successes in passing socially responsible investment screens. We are seeding 10 other campaigns in different cities in order to pass these resolutions of saying, no, we will not invest in companies that profit from human rights abuses. We're not signaling out Israel, but Israel belongs under human rights, just like it should be, and unlike the enforcement of the U.S. international law over the past 7 years. So the prophetic actions we take in the seminaries, we want to encourage the seminary students to go to Palestine and learn what's happening. We want to put Reverend Naeem's books in the seminaries. We have a bearing witness, which means going to Palestine and seeing what's happening. So these are the actions in our churches that are prophetic nowadays. And I say, if you are not with Palestinian justice and prophetic action now, you would not have stood with Martin Luther King in 1965 or 1960s.
You have been listening to Reverend Naeem Atik, director of the Sabeel Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center in Jerusalem, journalist and author Max Blumenthal, and Tariq Abwata of Friends of Sabeel North America. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.